Hello and welcome back to the Royal Horticultural Society Gardening Podcast. I'm Guy Barter, Chief Horticulturist here at the RHS. Coming up today, with increasing concerns about peat use in gardens and pollution from waste plastic, how can gardeners change their techniques and materials to become more environmentally friendly? I'll explain simple changes that can have a big impact to your carbon footprint. Plus, our advice team tackles some of your spring gardening questions. And pests! The figures are in, the votes have been counted, and our entomology team can announce the winners and new entries on the RHS annual top 10 chart of the most problematic pests in the UK. Stay tuned to see if slugs and snails can retain their coveted number one spot, or has a new contender stolen the crown. But first, as April is here and the snow has hopefully finished for the year, let's head outside to see what tasks the garden teams have been tackling.
So my name is Verity and I'm the team leader for the herbaceous team here at Wisley. We're currently standing in the summer house, which is located in Oakwood, and we're just having a look out. We can see some nice camellias out the door, nice rhododendrons which are about to burst open into flower. And we're just going to be talking today about a few jobs that we're going to be getting on with here at Wisley over the next few weeks, and things that you can equally be doing at home in your own gardens. So one of the jobs that we're going to be doing here is cutting back of our winter stems. So that includes things like Cornus, Salix and Rubus. We do those annually here at Wisley. We cut them back to a framework once a year, around about mid-March, but we actually do ours early April time, due to our winter walk finishing at the end of March. It is really important if you have any winter stems at home, especially if they're newly planted, that you let them establish for 2 years before cutting them back. They just need to be allowed to get their roots down, otherwise you'll cut the top off and they won't have enough energy in their roots to grow back. So yeah, leave them for 2 years, then after that second year you want to cut them down to a basic framework, quite low, but a basic framework that will then be the framework that you work to in the following years, just adding a couple of extra buds on every year. The aim is to keep that framework low for the best winter stem colour. Once we've cut them back, we look at applying a nice mulch and feeding them as well. Really important, we give them a nice general purpose food, just give them enough energy for the coming year. And then yeah, mulching as well, really important, it helps lock in the moisture as well, so the winter stems aren't stressed looking for moisture. We also mulch a lot of our other plants here at Wisley, a lot of our other borders. We use two types of mulch on my areas here at Wisley. We use bark mulch, which is we use more in the high profile areas. And we also use bracken mulch, which we use more here in Oakwood. It's got a more woodland feel to it, and the bracken mulch just fits in with that look a bit better. Other jobs we'll be getting on with are weeding. Anyone who's been out in their garden recently will notice that the weeds are starting to come up. They haven't been put off by the cold spell. So yeah, we're going to get out there and start weeding. We've noticed a few dandelions already popping their heads up and a bit of hairy bittercress as well. So we're getting out with the hoe and the fork. Take the opportunity as well to get out in your own gardens. And then also a bit of edging. We're going to start lawn edging here at Wisley. A lot of our beds here have got lawn edges. Perfect time again just to get out, crisp those edges up for the coming year. It'll just make your life so much easier for say the next season. You would really want to create a nice sharp edge, then all you have to do is whiz around with the edging shears for the rest of the year. Just makes your life so much easier.
If you'd like to see the results of our team's hard labour, there's lots of events on offer in the next few weeks for you to enjoy alongside the gardens, including the RHS Orchid Show and Plant Fair at our London HQ on the 6th and 7th of April. It's a celebration of exotic orchids and vibrant blooms with an amazing array of seasonal displays and specialist plants on offer from UK and international exhibitors. Discounted tickets are available for RHS members and there are free talks and demonstrations available to all visitors. See our podcast page for more information. April is one of the key times of year for taking measures to protect your vulnerable plants from damage from pests and diseases. Each season, our scientists help gardeners with research-based advice on a range of problems. And at the end of every growing year, they analyse the inquiries they've received from around the country to get an up-to-date picture of the challenges gardeners face. This helps the team recognise and trace the emergence of horticultural threats. We spoke to Andrew Salisbury in the entomology department to hear what pests caused gardeners in the UK the most problems in 2017.
So moving into what is the top five, A five, we have a relative newcomer. The alder leaf beetle. This is a nice blue beetle. It feeds on alder. It's about half a centimetre long. And it was thought to be native, but it went extinct in about 1947. Nobody saw it before 1947 until about 2004 in the UK, when it turned up in Cheshire. Since 2004, it began to build up in numbers and it was seen more and more often. And we received our first inquiry about this insect to the RHS in about 2010. But since then, it's been increasing and it's now very, very common in Cheshire, where it can be seen feeding on alder trees in quite large numbers. But a couple of years ago, it started to appear in Hampshire, in Winchester, and has also spread out from there, which has led to even more inquiries to us. So this one is, it does feed on leaves on alder trees, but like most deciduous trees, it's fine. It can cope with a bit of defoliation in the spring, and it's just a new and novel thing that people are seeing. So it's not something that people really need to be worried about, and it's just a nice blue beetle, as far as us entomologists are concerned. Dropping down a few places this year, number four, slugs and snails. I think in reality, this is usually the biggest pest problem people have in their gardens. Almost every garden will have a slug or snail problem. Everybody sees their plants nibbled. The reason why it's dropped down to number four, I think, is people are familiar with it, and also just the prevalence this year of some of the ones I'll be talking about coming up. Slug and snail control, it's a mixture of sort of hand-picking, tolerating a bit of damage, and if you're prepared to use chemicals, there are slug pellets and there are the organic slug pellets, which are said to be less dangerous to wildlife than the non-organic ones. At number three, we have vine weevil. Vine weevil is that pest that both the adults cause the leaf notching on things like rhododendron and thickly evergreen shrubs during in the summer, and that can be a bit disfiguring but doesn't kill plants. But it's the grubs, the white C-shaped things which feed away on plant roots over the winter months, which cause the most problems. Often you get to this sort of time of year expecting your plants to pull away and grow, and instead they just collapse and you lift them out of the pot and there's nothing left but these grubs. The thing with vine weevil is once you know you've got a problem is to treat pots and containers in late summer, early autumn to kill off the grubs so they don't feed on the roots over the winter. Again, this is a very, very widespread problem. And I would say it's as equal with slugs and snails. Most gardeners are familiar with it, but still require advice on how to deal with them. So into number two now, and fuchsia gall mite. If you grow fuchsias and they get distorted growing tips, this might be due to this tiny mite. The mite itself is about 0.3 of a millimetre in length. That's less than the third of the size of their average full stop. So they're not really visible without either a very good hand lens or a microscope. They, like most gall mites, they feed away on plant tissue and they cause it to distort. Now, almost all gall mites, this distortion is not really too disfiguring or it's something that the plant can be coped with. Unfortunately, on fuchsias, it affects the growth tips and it is very, very distorted indeed. It's a mite that arrived in the UK in about 2007. It originates from South America, first being described new to science in the late 70s. It was quite soon found in parts of the United States and California where it's caused big problems. And it began to turn up in Europe in the early 2000s. And it's thought to have been spread around by people moving cuttings about. It can almost be traced from plant flare to plant flare. As I say, eventually reached the UK in about 2007. It's now, since then, become very widespread on the south coast, both on hardy and non-hardy fuchsias. It seems to be surviving our winters. And by the south coast, I mean everywhere from Cornwall through to Kent has got this now. Fuchsia being such a popular plant and this being such a new problem, we are seeing it reported to us an awful lot. I think it's one that's not going to go away and I expect it will be in the top 10 for years to come. Fuchsia gall mite is very difficult to control. There are no chemicals or pesticides you can spray against these mites which are likely to have any effect. They are hidden way deep in the plant tissue. So really the advice is either dispose of infected plants, this could be by council waste or burning, or cut them back. Cut back those growing tips as far as you dare. The plants will regrow and you can hope you've at least reduced the mite for the time being. But it is something that fuchsia growers are going to have to learn to live with, and maybe pruning it out a bit more often. Right, and to reveal the number one, now this will probably become as no surprise to anybody who grows box in London or the surrounding areas, the box tree moth. This is an Asian moth, the caterpillars of which feed and are webbing and can completely defoliate box Buxus plants. Caterpillars themselves reach about 2.5 centimetres long. They are green and black, and as I say, feed underwebbing in large numbers together. They're a gregarious caterpillar. The moth itself has a wingspan of, getting on for 3 centimetres, is usually white with a brown edging, but there is also a dark brown melanic form, as it's called, and that does have a shiny appearance. Last year we received, getting on for 400 inquiries via the advisory service on this, which really prompted up to number one. But we also have a web survey on this, and that web survey received over 3,000 reports, largely from London and the home counties, of basically box hedges and box plants being completely and utterly defoliated. The insect originates from Southeast Asia, got into Europe in the early 2000s, and the damage in Central Europe is as bad as people are seeing in London. It is absolutely wiping out hillsides, gardens. You're getting thousands and thousands of moths appearing. How far it will spread in the UK, we don't yet know. So what can people do? This moth has 2 generations a year. It can fly in. There are vast numbers of them out there. It feeds under webbing. Caterpillars are difficult to get out with pesticides. You do need to force through that webbing. Hand picking is another option, but again, you're trying to get through that webbing. So in some areas, it might be time to consider alternatives, such as sweetbox, sarcococca, the small-leaved hollies, yews. These are all being considered now, where box tree moth and some of the box problems, which you may hear from our plant pathologists, such as the box blight, are making it very difficult to grow box.
Andrew Salisbury from the RHS Entomology Department. As mentioned earlier, you can find links to more info on our podcast page at rhs.org.uk/podcast. In our next episode, the science team will bring you a rundown of 2017's top 10 plant diseases across the UK. Now, question time. Our advisors help people with their gardening queries throughout the year, and spring is a particularly busy time for them. Let's join the team in their office to hear if they can help resolve problems they've been sent this month.
Hello, I'm Lee Hunt, Principal Horticulture Advisor at RHS Garden Wisley. Today I'm joined by Rob Sterling.
Hello.
And Guy Barter.
Hello.
Mr. A. Fletcher from London writes, I have a patio with several pots. I'd like to grow fruits or berries. Are there any which will thrive in containers? Are there any unusual berries I could grow? They are so expensive in the shops. Now, have you got any containers with fruiting, Guy?
Yeah, actually, interestingly, commercial growers have moved to container growing their fruit, their berries, because at one time they would treat the soil to get rid of pests and diseases with chemicals. This is no longer allowed, so they're growing plants in pots. So there's a lot of expertise on this at the moment. The main one is blueberries. Of course, blueberries are what we call an ericaceous plant. That means it must have an acid soil to thrive. So happily, you can buy ericaceous compost, which is nice and acid, and will support blueberries without the telltale signs of yellowing leaves, which is what happens if the soil is too alkaline. Blueberries are one of the most popular berries in the supermarket, so I imagine they would suit Mr. or Mrs. Fletcher very well. Closely related to the blueberries are cranberries. And cranberries are a low-growing plant. They're like the things that you find on the moors, for example, like bilberries. So they're quite a low-growing plant, a small yield, but they're easy to grow. Again, they're an ericaceous plant. They need ericaceous compost. You could, for example, if you had a big pot, you could plant them as ground cover underneath a tall blueberry. So those are two excellent berries to grow. They're not too fussy about shade or sun. They won't thrive in deep shade, but if there's partial shade for part of the day, they'll be fine. Now, of course, strawberries and raspberries are easy to grow in containers. To make life easy for the gardener, plant breeders have bred some dwarf raspberries recently, and they, of course, are very easy to grow. If you put an ordinary raspberry in a container, it's not at all impossible, it's not even that difficult, but of course you do have to find some way of staking them and supporting them. All raspberries are not the same. There's some rather interesting purple ones. There's one called Glencoe, for example, and they're easy to grow in containers too. Particularly if there's children, they're much appreciated because you can pick them off one by one as they ripen. They won't produce a heavy crop, but they will produce a particularly interesting and different flavoured fruit. The plant breeders have also been busy with mulberries. Mulberries used to be a plant that grew into a large tree, would often take 10 years before they crop. There's a dwarf mulberry on the market at the moment that crops almost immediately. Very simple to prune, a most unusual and innovative plant. It's interesting to see how well it's going to do in Britain, but all the indications are from the trials that it's something that's well worth considering. So really the time has never been better to grow berries in containers.
Any apples and pears that are suitable, Rob?
Yes, apples and pears are perfectly suitable to grow in containers. Try to avoid the apples, for example, on the dwarfest rootstock, which is the M27, because growing in a container coupled with the fact that it's on an M27 rootstock can lead to reduced vigour in the tree. Something like an M106, which is semi-vigorous, would be a much better option. Bear in mind, though, that the trees, in order to keep them healthy, will require repotting after, say, 2 to 3 years, potting up into a larger container as they grow. Once they reach the largest pot size that you can manage, perhaps every 3 or 4 years, consider root pruning, which will mean take away about an inch of the outside of the root ball and then put the plant back into the same size pot. That will keep the plant healthy and vigorous almost indefinitely. But there are some dwarf peaches and nectarines which are naturally dwarfing and would be suitable for growing in containers. One variety of peach is called Garden Lady, and there's a nectarine called Nectarella. The difference between these two and, say, apples and pears is that they're self-fertile. Many apples need a pollinating partner, as do pears. So growing one of those varieties isn't necessarily sufficient in order to get fruit. But certainly with the peach and the nectarine, that is possible. Do bear in mind, though, that both of those varieties would be susceptible to peach leaf curl, which can be prevented by keeping the new foliage clear of water, maybe placing the pots under cover during the time when the foliage is emerging in order to prevent that disease. There is, though, a new variety called Avalon Pride, which is a regular peach tree, but it is resistant to peach leaf curl. So that's something else that is possible to consider. Okay, so David Crest from Manchester writes, colour in September. How do I get some colour in my dull terrace garden in September? I have a strip lawn and annual borders. Any suggestions for flowers and foliage for colour in the late summer or autumn?
Well, I think September is actually a month of two halves because it kind of marks the change between late summer and very much the autumn plants. And often to bridge that proper September gap, you need two almost distinct groups. So for earlier in the month, I would start with something like Rebecca Goldstone. This has a ray-like yellow flowers that are daisy-like with black centres, and they will really start in August and carry on to mid-September. But by that point, they're beginning to wane. So to carry on the display, start to rely on the old Michaelmas daisies or asters. All sorts of various strains to try here. I rather like the one called Little Carlo. This has more loose spray-like head of lilac-y mauve flowers. And in the centre, you get little yellow centres that have little red bits as well. That will take you through into about early October. But if you want to extend beyond, it's one of the horizontalis asters called Lady in Black is very good. It has dark foliage through the summer, which looks very good against other plants, contrasting from the green. But then you do get those little pink and white blooms coming out as well. One plant that will keep going right through until November is Geranium Roseanne. In some places it's almost overused now, but the white-centred blue flowers of that, if you cut them back in about August time and then give them really good water, will look very fresh into September, October.
I was going to suggest sunflowers, because if they're sown in May, they'd be easy to put into an annual border. And if they're the branching kind, they'll go on and flower for quite a long time and make good cut flowers in the house. I think asters are a wonderful thing, but they can be demons for mildew. But there's one that's on the blue side called Monk, which is a wonderful thing to grow. If we're talking about plants from seeds, it might well be for Mr. Crest here with his annual borders. Korean chrysanthemums have dropped out of fashion over the last few years, but the seed can still be grown and they make splendid chrysanthemum plants free of any vice that go on until the first frosts knock them on the head.
And of course, the Japanese anemone is a good stalwart for the autumn garden and is particularly useful in areas where there's perhaps dry shade, because they will grow and flower quite happily in those conditions as well as in more regular sunny, moist ones. And of course, dahlias as well become very fashionable again over the past few years. They will flower right up until the first frosts and are now available in a variety of different sizes and forms. So there's plenty to choose from.
S. Pike from Bristol writes, a rather short but not very sweet question. Can I compost dog poo? Guy.
Oh, I've definitely drawn the short straw here, haven't I? Yes, you can certainly compost dog poo. It'll rot down in the compost heap and it'll disappear. However, dogs are well known to carry quite a large burden of parasites, which is why one has to worm them at regular intervals. These parasites are potentially quite harmful. They pose a bit of a risk to children, and the eggs that these parasites produce are pretty durable. So I'm not convinced that in garden compost they would be destroyed. So I'm afraid that on health grounds, particularly if children are involved, I would strongly recommend that you don't compost dog poo.
The final question comes from Claire Blurton, and she asks, how can I cultivate edamame peas? I have an allotment in Nantwich. Guy.
Well, edamame or edamame, I'm never quite sure how it should be said, are one of my very favourite vegetables. Whenever I go to a certain Japanese restaurant chain, I always have a lovely bowl of these soya bean pods that have been steamed and covered in salt, and then you pop the little tender beans into your mouth and eat them, and they're delicious, absolutely delicious. Unfortunately, the soya beans that are grown in Japan are a different kind of soya beans that can be grown in Europe, because the soya bean is what's called day length sensitive, so that it won't flower until it has short days. However, soya beans have been bred in places like Ukraine and Canada to cope with higher latitudes. As you get closer to the poles, the difference in day length gets longer, and these ones can be grown. So although they make a fair crop of soya beans for cows and pigs, they are not great soya beans for edamame. You can eat them, and they're relatively easy to grow. To grow, just think French beans. Sow them in modules or cell trays in April, plant out in May, gather a crop from late summer onwards. Now, finally, one of the issues of concern to many gardeners I meet through my work in RHS gardens, at shows, and when visiting community projects is environmentally conscious gardening. That's how people can change the material they use, from plant pots to growing media, to recycle more and make better use of precious natural resources. At this time of year, many of us are thinking about stocking up on growing media for sowing seeds and potting plants. Traditionally, for the last 50 years, growing media has been made from peat, but peat is not a renewable source, and extracting peat from lowland bogs causes great damage, irreparable in less than hundreds of years, to the environment that is rather rare and unique. This applies all across the world, so even in countries with even more peat than Britain and Ireland, there are still concerns. Government-sponsored drives to reduce the use of peat have put pressure on the manufacturers of growing media to reduce the peat and replace it with other things. The kind of things that are used in place of peat are wood fibre, bark chips, coconut fibre, commonly called coir, and municipal compost. Some kinds of compost are what are called peat reduced, where perhaps the peat only accounts for 30% of the peat, and that's a good step in the right direction. But even better are peat-free compost that are based entirely on these other materials. Peat-free compost are not the same as peat-based composts. They have to be handled differently. So it's really important to read the instructions on the packaging that the compost come in. For example, very often more watering is needed to wash out surplus nutrients that come from the municipal compost and which would otherwise scorch plant roots. So we would urge gardeners to at least experiment with peat-free media and gradually and perhaps quickly eliminate peat-based growing media from your gardening and replace it with peat-free material. This includes growing bags. There are peat-free growing bags available, and peat-free growing media is particularly useful for big tubs and containers, and they, after all, are the ones that use the most compost. I think we've all been horrified by the amount of plastic waste in the environment following recent publicity. And of course, plastics are, as in all walks of life, and everything we do in life, are very important in gardening. For example, plastic plant pots are one of the best ways of retailing plants, but there's also the problem of what to do with the plant pots. So they, up till now, they've not really been recyclable in any but a very small way. However, following recent concerns, new recycling schemes are coming online, so we trust that in future you'll be able to return pots to garden centres and nurseries and they'll be recycled or reused. There's other kinds of plastic too. Some things like string, natural string is much, much better than plastic string. Plastic string is a bit of a mess, a menace. It degrades the soil and you can never get rid of it, whereas natural string just rots away to nothing. Plastic labels are also a nuisance, but unfortunately, there's not many things quite as durable. All the same, for certain uses, for example, labelling trees and shrubs, you can use copper labels that'll last forever, and wooden labels are feasible for short-term things. Often we clad greenhouses and polythene tunnels in plastic, and we protect plants with low tunnels and plastic cloches, and we cover them with horticultural fleece, which is a kind of a non-woven plastic transparent material for protecting plants from cold and wind. These things are degraded in the sunlight, and so recycling them is particularly difficult. It's worth considering replacing your greenhouses or polytunnels with glass-clad structures, making use of glass cold frames, and investing in glass cloches. Things like glass cloches cost more, but they last for a very long time. In gardening, as in all walks of life, there are ways in which you can reduce your plastic footprint. As always, for more information, check the links on the RHS website. Well, that's all we have time for now. From me, Guy Barter, and all of us at the RHS, goodbye.